නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස Okay, today we will be taking for discussion the Margandeya Sutta. This is Sutta number 75 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Is the recorder working? This is one of the strongest, most powerful, in some ways more difficult suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this sutta takes place when the Buddha was living in the Kuru country. The Kuru country corresponds to, in contemporary India, to Uttara Pradesh. And the town of Kamasadhamma, where the sutta unfolds, is sometimes taken to be either very close to present-day Delhi or even the original town that developed into Delhi. And it was in this town that the Buddha gave several of his most important discourses, including the famous Satipatthana Sutta on the four establishments of mindfulness, the Mahanidana Sutta, the great discourse on causation, the Anenja Sabhaya Sutta, and other very deep, difficult discourses. Okay, and at the time that this discourse takes place, the Buddha is not living accompanied by the Sangha, by the monks, but he's staying alone and living in the fire chamber of a Brahmin who belonged to the Bharadvaja clan. That's one of the most important Brahmin clans in ancient India. And he must have asked the Brahmin for permission to stay in his fire chamber. Perhaps this is the chamber where the Brahmin conducts the all-important fire ceremony, according which is prescribed in the Vedas. And so it would not be a room that ordinary people would stay in, but generally it would be reserved for those living a religious life. And the Buddha, as he so often did, is just sleeping on a mat just made out of grass. And so one day the Buddha dresses, takes his bowl and extra robes, and goes into the town for alms round. After he finishes wandering for alms and then takes his meal, then he enters a grove nearby in order to spend his day in meditation. And now while the Buddha was away from the Brahmin's fire chamber, a certain wanderer by the name of Margandeya arrived at this fire chamber. Now, according to the commentary, there are several figures mentioned by the name of Margandeya in the suttas. According to the commentary, one of them was the uncle, the other was the nephew. The uncle, according to the commentary, had become a monk and attained arhatship. And when his nephew heard about this, he was upset and became very critical of the Buddha for converting his uncle and ordaining him as a monk. And now this person, the nephew who was called Margandeya, is described as a wanderer. In Pali, this is paribhajaka, which means somebody who lives a life of wandering. He doesn't live in a settled residence, but he lives what seems to be an ascetic type of life, not having a fixed abode, but wandering from place to place. But strangely, as we will see, this wanderer is an advocate of hedonism, of the indulgence of the senses, rather than of restraint and self-control, as is typical for the ascetics. So when the wanderer Magandhya arrives at the fire chamber of the Brahmin, he sees this spread of grass, this mat of grass spread out on the ground, and the idea comes to him somehow that there must be an ascetic living here, staying here, spending the nights here, perhaps because he understood that the Brahmin himself would not live in the fire chamber and ordinary people would not be permitted to stay there. And so the wanderer Magandhya asked the Brahmin for whom he has put out this mat of grass. And then he says, it seems like it might be the bed of a recluse, of an ascetic. And so then the Brahmin says that, again, these seem to be words put in his mouth by the compilers of the canon, that, because this is a stock phrase, there is an ascetic named Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who has gone forth from the Sakyan clan. A good report has been spread about him, that he is the blessed one, the accomplished one, the fully enlightened one, and so on. And this bed has been prepared for him. And now when Magandhya hears this, then his mind is, apparently it's inflamed, because he realizes that this ascetic Gotama is the very same one who is converted and ordained his uncle. And so he says, indeed, Master Bharadvaja, it is a ill sight, or you could say an unlucky sight, or even a distressing sight, that we see the bed of this Master Gotama. And then he uses a word to describe him. The word in Pali, it's a rather puzzling meaning, called bhūnahu. And the commentary takes this word to, or explicates this word as meaning a destroyer of growth. And again, even that sense, just taken on its own, is rather obscure. We might perhaps render it more freely as perhaps it has a sense of being a repressionist. So that seems to be the intended sense, the repressionist. Then the Brahmin says, he warns Magandhya, be careful what you are saying, be careful what you are saying. There are many distinguished people, nobles, Brahmins, householders, and so on, who have placed full confidence in this recluse Gotama, and they have been guided by him along the noble path and the wholesome Dharma. Then Magandhya says, he wants to stick by his word, so he says, even if we saw that ascetic Gotama face to face, I would tell him to his face, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth, or a repressionist. And then he says, why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. And the Pali word here is sutta, or Sanskrit sutra. It's a little puzzling how this could be recorded in the scriptures of the wanderers. Perhaps there's a statement to the effect that one who teaches control and sense restraint is a repressionist, destroyer of growth. Maybe it doesn't mention specifically the recluse Gotama. And I have to say, now in retrospect, I see that the word scripture here is not quite appropriate, since scripture means literally something which is scripted, written down. And in those ancient times, the sacred texts of the different religious creeds were not written down, but they were transmitted orally. So you could say that is recorded in our sacred texts. Then the Brahmin says that, he addresses Magandhya, and he says, if you have no objection, may I tell this to Master Gotama? He wants to get permission. And the Brahmin says, be at ease. Oh, I'm sorry, Magandhya says to the Brahmin, let Master Bharadvaja be at ease. You could tell him whatever you want. You could even report to him just what I have said. Okay, meanwhile, while this conversation is taking place, the Buddha is still presumably sitting in meditation in the grove that he has entered. But the Buddha, somehow when a conversation takes place of some importance to himself, he will become aware of it through his special faculty of knowledge. And then with the faculty called the divine ear, he was able to listen in on this conversation. The divine ear is a special faculty of hearing which develops as a result of the achievement of very deep states of samadhi. It's a faculty that enables a person to hear sounds taking place, or even conversations taking place at a great distance, to hear sounds being made by very small creatures that ordinary humans cannot hear. For example, it's said that one could hear the sounds of little tiny insects, bacteria perhaps. And one can hear conversations taking place in other realms of existence. Now, according to the commentary, the reason why the Buddha attended to this conversation, specifically at this point, is that the Buddha had come on this journey expressly because he knew that this Wandara Magandhya had the potential to achieve arhatship. The Buddha, every day in the very early part of the morning, he looks out over the world with his divine eye, and is able to look more than with his Buddha eye, and is able to see the mind states of living beings, of sentient beings. And he could see which beings, especially which human beings, have the potential for awakening, which just needs his presence, his instruction, his guidance, to bring that potential to actualization, to fulfillment. And so, several days earlier, the Buddha had seen with his special Buddha vision that this Wandara Magandhya, Magandhya was so angry and hostile to the Buddha, but he knew that this was just what we call surface garbage, and that underneath that surface garbage, Magandhya had planted wholesome roots, meritorious roots under previous Buddhas, and that all of this potential was just ready to burst forth and ripen as soon as the Buddha engaged him in a conversation. And so the Buddha had made this trip especially to target Magandhya as a field of awakening, of enlightenment. And he was listening in on this conversation because he knew that this would be give him some guidelines for how to instruct Magandhya. Okay, so the Buddha was listening in on this conversation, and in the evening, the Buddha got up from his meditation, returned to the fire chamber, and sat down on the spread of grass. Then the Brahmin comes into the fire chamber, exchanges greetings with the Buddha. And then after they exchange their greetings, then the Buddha asks him, he says, you see, the Brahmin was about to tell the Buddha what had taken place about this conversation. So the Buddha says, Bharadvaja, did you happen to have any conversation with a wanderer named Magandhya about this grass mat? And then the Brahmin was awestruck, wonderstruck. And he said, I wanted to tell you about this very thing, but you have anticipated us. Okay, now while the two were just having a discussion, then the wanderer Magandhya appeared on the scene. It says in the text that he exchanged greetings with the Blessed One and they exchanged courteous and amiable talk with him. But perhaps the talk was not so courteous and amiable. And it was probably the case that after Magandhya had left the Brahmin, and went off into his own quarters. His mind maybe was bubbling over with thoughts that, okay, this ascetic Gotama has appeared on the scene now. That's the one who's created so much trouble for my family by converting my uncle. And now I know that he's living in that fire chamber. When it gets dark, I'll go there myself and engage him in debate. Okay, so when, after they exchange their greetings, then the Buddha is going to make a statement which helps to explicate the meaning of this phrase, Bhūnahu, which is translated destroyer of growth. The Buddha says to him, Magandhya, the eye delights in forms, takes delight in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained. And he teaches the Dhamma for the purpose of its restraint. Was it with reference to this that you said the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? And then the wanderer Magandhya says, it was precisely with reference to this that I said that you are a destroyer of growth. And why is that? Because this is recorded, or this is preserved in our sacred text. Now from this statement, and the same thing is repeated with regard to the other five senses, the ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind faculty. In the case of each one, naturally the sense faculty, or really it's the mind moving through the sense faculty that takes delight in its respective type of object. So with the ordinary, uncontrolled, undeveloped mind is repeatedly going out through each of the six senses, seeking pleasurable and delightful objects through those senses. And when it finds a pleasant, agreeable object, then it takes delight in that object. It rejoices in the objects. It tries to experience these objects more intensely, to experience a greater variety of them, and to hold to them and cling to them. And according to the commentary to this sutta, Magandhya was an advocate of hedonism. His belief, his doctrine, was that the six senses should be freely indulged. One should enjoy whatever forms one has never experienced before. And those that one has enjoyed previously, those one can indulge in again and again. One should try to experience any sounds one has never heard before, any delightful sounds, any smells, any tastes, any touches. And the person who tries to control the senses, according to this philosophy, is a foolish, deluded person, one who is missing the great opportunity that life offers to obtain as much enjoyment as possible, as great a variety of pleasures as possible, as great an intensity of experience as possible. And so, in taking this position, Magandhya and the Buddha are clashing on a very fundamental point, because the Buddha has taught, as part of his training or discipline, especially for those seeking the highest and final goal, that the five senses, the five physical senses, and the mind faculty are to be restrained, to be controlled. But this is not a kind of puritanical repressionism where one nurtures the desire within, but one presses it down and pushes it away. But it's a process of gradually training and taming oneself to give up a lower pleasure, an entangling and binding pleasure, in order to find a higher, more ennobling and liberating pleasure. And so even though the ultimate goal is this supreme state of bliss or nibbana, but one has to begin by denying oneself the liberty to indulge freely in the enjoyment of the senses. And then one, by controlling the senses, one protects the mind from being flooded, inundated by unwholesome states, by lust, greed, and craving for the enjoyable objects, by aversion and displeasure and dejection on account of disagreeable objects. And then by controlling the senses, one is able to get a firm grip on the process of the mind and can train the mind to the mind to focus more and more undistractedly upon its object, and that focusing of the mind, collecting and composing of the mind, will eventually bring states of deeper absorption and then lead to the insight knowledges and ultimately to the knowledge of liberation or deliverance. Okay, so now the Buddha is not just going to submit to Magandhya, but he's going to guide him with a step-by-step instruction and bring him to recognize the unsatisfactoriness and sensual indulgence. So he begins with the case, here I'm in paragraph 9. Here someone may have formerly enjoyed himself with forms cognizable by the eye, forms that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. On a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of forms, he might abandon craving for forms, remove fever for forms, and abide without thirst with the mind inwardly at peace. Okay, now the Buddha is taking the case of somebody who has grown up apparently in a well-to-do family, as one of the prosperous, maybe an aristocratic family, Brahmin family, a family of affluent householders, and has free access to the pleasures of the senses. And this person has been able to enjoy the sense experience. But on a later occasion, there awakens with him the gleam of recognition, of realization, into five important aspects of sensory experience. The first two go together. This is their origin and disappearance. I put the Pali for some of our Pali students. The first two go together, that all sensory objects arise and pass away, arise and pass away. They have origination. When they arise, they might persist just for a moment, and then they vanish and disappear. And then even those that are perceived to last for some time, all of them originate through conditions. They're supported by conditions. And when the conditions fade away, or when the conditions become inoperative, then the dependent phenomena disappears. So everything experienced through the senses is arising and perishing, moment by moment, and also those things that apparently last do so through conditions and vanish with the cessation of those conditions. So by mentioning origin and disappearance, the Buddha is speaking or referring to which particular feature or characteristic of phenomena. impermanence, anicca. And by referring to impermanence, here you could draw out from this the other two major characteristics, that they're all conditioned phenomena, are unsatisfactory and insubstantial or without any self. And then that becomes more explicit with the other three angles or perspectives from which we regard the phenomena. I discussed these about 2 or 3 weeks ago when we did the Mahadukkha Khanda Sutta. Okay, all sensory objects that are pleasant and agreeable, they give a certain satisfaction or gratification. This is called asada, a word which means literally sweet taste. And so one gets some enjoyment from beautiful forms, lovely harmonious sounds. And the gratification or enjoyment in the sense objects consists in the pleasure and joy that arise dependent upon them. And through that pleasure and joy, there comes a clinging to them, a craving for more of them, and a clinging to them. And that opens up what's called the danger, the adhinava. The danger, the misery, the drawback or pitfall in them is the fact that they are impermanent, that they never give full, lasting satisfaction, and they are subject to decay and disappearance. And then the escape from the sense, the whole field of sensory impressions. The word escape doesn't mean escapism, but it's the release or deliverance from them, is the removal of desire and craving for them. We find these terms in the outline I gave the note, that to find textual explanations of these terms, you look in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 35, suttas 13 to 20. Okay, so this person being spoken of in the sutta, now, after enjoying the sense objects, has recognized that they are impermanent, that even though they do give pleasure and enjoyment, to cling to them is to expose oneself to suffering, to make oneself vulnerable to suffering when they vanish and disappear. And so he first seeks the escape from them by putting away desire and craving for them. And then when he abandons this craving for form, then he's able to dwell with a mind inwardly at peace. And if you pay close attention to the wording here, you see that the Buddha uses three words to refer to craving. Well, first is craving itself, tanha, but then it's glossed by another word, which is translated fever, parilaha, which is quality of burning, kind of inward burning. This is when a person doesn't get the forms that he or she wants, then it feels like the mind is on fire. I want, I want, I want. And when they get what they want, then it's like a fire consuming its fuel. Enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Burning up forms, burning up sounds, burning up smell, taste, touches, ideas. And then it's not only a fever, but a fever makes one thirsty. And so then one becomes afflicted with the thirst, or intense longing for repetition of the sensory enjoyment. And so when the person abandons the craving, at the same time that is the cooling down of the fever, the quenching of the thirst, and so this person now dwells with a mind inwardly at peace. And so then the Buddha says to Magandhya, what would you say to him? In other words, he's saying, wouldn't you encourage him, go out and enjoy yourself? Why are you sitting there in your room when you could be out going to nightclubs, to concerts, to parties? But Magandhya is left speechless. You can just say nothing, Master Gotama. Okay, the same thing is repeated with regard to the other sensory object. Then the Buddha says, now in a way he's indicating that the person, the hypothetical person that he was referring to in paragraph 9, that he himself is an example of this. He says, formerly when I lived the home life, this is when he was the prince, the Shakyan prince, I enjoyed myself with all the five sensory objects. And then here we have the famous passage from which becomes part of the traditional Buddha's biography. I had three palaces, one for the rainy season, one for the cold season, and one for the summer. Those are the three main seasons in India and South Asia. And then during the rainy season, which was the last 4 months, I lived in the rain's palace, enjoying myself with musicians, none of whom were men. In other words, they were all women. And I did not go down to the lower palace. He just stayed upstairs. His servants would bring him, if they were, according to the commentary, even the servants were women, they would bring him everything that he wanted, and so he could freely enjoy the pleasures of the senses. But on a later occasion, having understood as they actually are the origin, disappearance, gratification, danger, and escape in the case of sensual pleasures, I abandoned craving for sensual pleasures, removed fever of the sensual pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. And now he goes on, I see other beings, or here the beings are other people, who are not free from lust or sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures. Very powerful word. Kajamana is the Pali. Being eaten up, burning with the fever for sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them, nor do I delight therein. And why is that? Because there is, Magandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, in other words, the lower sensual pleasures, nor do I delight therein. Now, what is the Buddha referring to here by this delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states? Now, beyond the domain or realm of sensory experience, there are certain dimensions of experience available, accessible, only through meditation. These are called the jhanas, or translated meditative absorption. And these are reached, have to be reached by giving up indulgence and enjoyment of sense pleasures and training the mind in the practice of samadhi meditation. There are four jhanas, four stages of meditative absorption. In the first jhana, the distinctive features are pleasure or happiness, rapture and happiness. But there's still thinking going on. Beyond the first jhana, there is another deeper state of absorption in which the subtle thinking process falls away, and there remains pleasure or happiness and rapture or joy. In the third, even the rapture or joy falls away, and there is just a very highly refined pleasure or bliss. And beyond that, there is a fourth jhana, fourth absorption, in which even the pleasant feeling falls away and is replaced by equanimity. But those meditative absorptions still belong to the mundane world, to the conditioned world. And it's not this that the Buddha is referring to, though the Buddha has mastery over the jhanas, and he, from time to time, enters into the jhanas. But the jhanas themselves serve as a basis for the development of insight, the insight knowledges. And it is through the insight knowledges that one reaches the stages of, call them, the realization, the breakthrough to the supreme truth. And it is by making this, reaching these stages of penetration or realization, that one uproots all of the defilements. And when all of the defilements are uprooted, one gains access to a special meditative state, which is available, accessible, only to a fully liberated one. Technically, this state is called Arahata Pala Samapatti. Yeah, the commentary uses the term for this, Arahata Pala Samapatti. Samapatti means meditative attainment. Pala means fruition or fruit. And this is the fruit of arhatship. And the Buddha is also an arhat. The arhat is one who has uprooted all the defilements. And so this is a kind of taintless, absolutely taintless state of mind, a state of perfect freedom, blissful freedom. And so in the suttas, this state is referred to as vimutti sukha, which means the happiness or bliss of liberation. And this is a special kind of meditative absorption which only a fully liberated person, an arhant or Buddha, can enter, in which they experience directly the mind is absorbed in nirvana, the state of nirvanic bliss while alive. So now, in this passage, the Buddha is referring to this attainment, that this is the delight which surpasses even divine bliss. And now, to show the Buddha's relation to those who are enjoying, indulging in sense pleasures, the Buddha uses now an analogy or a simile. He says, suppose there is a householder, very wealthy, who has access to all the five objects of sense pleasure. But he leads a righteous, virtuous life, and then after death, he is reborn in a heavenly world, in the retinue of the gods of the 33. This is one of the heavenly worlds, the Tavatings or Devaloka. And there, he's surrounded by a group of nymphs in the Nandana Grove, and he's able to enjoy himself, provided endowed with the five cords of divine or of divine sensual pleasure. Now, I don't know if you'll believe this, whether it sounds like a fairy tale to you, but there are above the human realm, above is used metaphorically, various heavenly worlds. And the beings who are living in these worlds, these are called devas, often translated gods. So they're not like creator gods, but they are just living beings who are able to, because they've been reborn there through good karma, they have a very long lifespan, very beautiful bodies. They radiate light from their bodies. They travel about freely. They don't have to work 9-to-5 jobs. No telephones to answer. No computer emails to answer. They communicate by telepathy. And they enjoy freely sense pleasures. And of course, this represents maybe the views of a patriarchal society, but each male deva is depicted as being surrounded by a retinue of female devas or nymphs. And then they enjoy themselves from morning to night. Okay, now this householder who has been reborn there, suppose he were to sort of peek down through the clouds and focus his supervision, divine vision, down to the human world, and to see another householder enjoying himself with the five chords of human sensual pleasure. And what do you think, while he's up there surrounded by these nymphs enjoying himself, would he envy this householder in the human world who's indulging in the five chords of sensual pleasure while having to answer the telephone, wash the dishes after meals, go to the toilet at certain times of the day, do the house cleaning. And even if he didn't, even if the householder had all of these mundane tasks taken care of for him, still the sense pleasures in the human world are considered far, far inferior to those in the divine, in the heavenly world. And so the Mahatma Gandhi says that the householder has been reborn as a god wouldn't have any envy for the human householder. The reason is that heavenly sensual pleasures are more excellent and sublime than human sensual pleasures. And so then the Buddha repeats the same passage as above, explaining how, by analogy, just as this newly born deva, god in the heavenly world, wouldn't have any envy or resentment towards the householder in the human world because he realizes that his pleasure is far superior to that of the human householder. So the Buddha says that when I see other beings indulging in sensual pleasures, I don't envy them at all, because I can experience a state of delight apart from sensual pleasures and unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Okay, now after that elevated simile, the Buddha now uses a very stark, almost a grotesque series of similes. He'll give three similes of a leper who has sores and blisters on his limbs, and the sores have opened up, and worms are breeding inside and eating away at the flesh, and the wounds are itching, constantly itching, and so the leper is scratching himself to alleviate the itch, and as he does so, he breaks the scabs off the wound so that they are opening up again and becoming vulnerable to attack by creatures, by insects that will devour the flesh. And then to alleviate the pain, he's cauterizing his body over a burning charcoal pit. Then his friends and companions bring a physician to treat him, and the physician makes medicine for him, and by means of that medicine the man would be cured of his leprosy, and he becomes well and happy, he's independent, he can go about wherever he wants. And then he might see another leper, again with sores and blisters on his limbs, scratching himself, cauterizing his body over the burning charcoal pit. And this leper, while he's doing this, he's getting some pleasure. He's alleviating the itch. Oh, scratching. Oh, that feels good. Wonderful. But he's putting the body over the burning cold pit. Oh, how intensely pleasurable it feels. And so now the leper has been cured. One leper, and he sees another one, and he sees this leper, the second leper, moaning and groaning with pleasure as he scratches his itches and heats up the body. And then maybe somebody says, would you like to return to that state? Aren't you missing that pleasure and delight that you were able to experience? And he thinks, I would give up my left arm, but I would not want to go back to being a leper like that, having to spend the whole day from morning to night standing by that charcoal pit, cauterizing the body, scratching. Always have to stay near the charcoal pit. Always scratching, hardly even time to take a meal. When takes one bite, has to stop and scratch. Lies down to sleep, can hardly fall asleep, itching. Okay, so would that man who's now been cured of his leprosy, envy the leper for his burning charcoal pit or his use of the medicine? And the answer is no. Okay, that is the first simile. Okay, now we come to a second simile. Again, this is a very powerful simile. We have this leper with the sores and blisters on his limbs, again scratching. Then his friends and companions bring the physician treats him, he's cured, able to go where he likes. And then two strong men come along and seize him by both arms and drag him towards a burning charcoal pit. What would that man do? Wouldn't he twist his body this way and that? And Magandhi says, yes, Master Gotama. And why is that? Because the fire is indeed painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now the Buddha asks a pointed question. He says, is it only now that fire is painful to touch, hot and scorching? Or previously too, was that fire painful to touch, hot and scorching? And Magandhya says, both now and also previously, that fire was painful to touch, hot and scorching. For when that man was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs, devoured by worms and so on, scratching the scabs off the openings of his wounds, his faculties were impaired. His faculties were not in a normal condition. And thus, even though the fire was actually painful to touch, he acquired a mistaken perception of it as pleasant. And here, this is like the loaded expression, and it must have been put into the mouth of Magandhya by the compilers of the suttas, because it's making an oblique reference to a particular Buddhist doctrinal concept, which is that of the distorted or inverted perception. Pali is viparita sanya. That's the perception which is upside down, distorted or inverted. Dian Dao Xiang. And according to Buddhist texts, there are four types of distorted perception. There's distorted perception of what is really impermanent as permanent, the inverted perception of what is really dukkha, suffering or unsatisfactory, as being happiness or pleasurable, the distorted perception of what is not self as being self, and then distorted perception of what is not beautiful as being beautiful, what is not lovely as being lovely. And here the idea being indicated is that this is a distorted perception of what is really painful, the fire, the blazing fire, as being pleasurable. And the reason why it's pleasurable is because this man has this terrible, he's consumed by this terrible disease. And because he's consumed by that disease, his faculties are impaired, so they're not functioning normally. And so when he exposes his body to the hot fire, he feels pleasure, relief. But the fire, it's really, if a normal person goes there, the normal person will feel intense pain. Okay, so now the Buddha applies the simile, the analogy. He says, so too, Magandhya, in the past, sensual pleasures were painful to touch, hot and scorching. In the future, sensual pleasures will be painful to touch, hot and scorching. And now, at present, sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching. But as they actually, in a sense, they aren't really painful to touch, hot and scorching. If they were, people wouldn't be attracted to them. They actually give pleasure when one approaches them with an undeveloped mind, with a mind covered over by ignorance and delusion. But if one sees them as they really are, then one would see that they are causes of bondage and suffering. And so then one can describe them as painful to touch, hot and scorching. And so the Buddha now says, even though the sensual pleasures are painful to touch, hot and scorching, these beings, these people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with fever for sensual pleasures, have faculties that are impaired. That is, this craving influences all of the senses. So as a result, even though sensual pleasures are actually painful to touch, these people acquire a viparita sanya, a distorted perception of them as pleasant. In other words, they have the, what do you call it, dukkha sukha sanya viparita. They have a distorted perception of perceiving pleasure in what is really suffering or painful. But one who looks at the sensual pleasures with the eye of wisdom will see that these sensual pleasures, even though they give enjoyment, they give delight, but they become a sort of cause of attachment, cause of addiction, and cause of bondage. I think that's going to be the point now of the next simile. Okay, paragraph 17. Suppose, Magandhya, there was a leper with sores and blisters on his limbs and so forth. He's cauterizing his body over the charcoal pit, scratching and cauterizing the body. Then the more he scratches his wounds, and the more he cauterizes his body, the fouler, the more evil-smelling and more infected the openings of his wounds would become. Yet he would find a certain measure of satisfaction an enjoyment in scratching the openings of his wounds. And so this is the way the leper gets involved in this kind of vicious cycle. He has, okay, the illness has arisen, this leprosy or the skin disease, whatever it is. So he starts itching, he scratches, he gets pleasure, relief, now it's finished and done with. But as a result of scratching, he aggravates the illness. And so it becomes more, his condition deteriorates. And so after a few minutes, he starts itching again, but the itch is even stronger than previously. So now he scratches more strongly, and he rips up his skin and flesh, so more insects come in and start devouring the flesh. Sorry, I know. Rather not such a pleasant picture to And then, okay, more insects come in, so then he starts itching, more, the itch becomes more painful, he starts scratching, more pleasure, more relief. Then he pauses, and a few moments later the itch starts. And so this goes on over and over until he's just utterly destroying his body. But he's getting pleasure and satisfaction from it, so he's enjoying it. Okay, so now the Buddha says, in the same way, people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasure, devoured by craving for sensual pleasures and so on, still indulge in sensual pleasures. And the more they indulge in the sensual pleasures, the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burnt by their fever for sensual pleasures. Yet they find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in dependence on the five cords of sensual pleasure. Okay, so this seems to be the vicious cycle in regard to sensual pleasures. There comes, you could say, how many phases in the cycle? So the Buddha is describing a kind of spiral-like pattern regarding sensuality. There's a phase of, say, initially arising desire, then one indulges that desire, one gets a certain pleasure and satisfaction from it, that gives a relief, but the relief, phase of relief, is followed by another phase of more intense desire. And then there comes the compulsion for more enjoyment, more indulgence. That brings its reward of pleasure temporarily, but then that pleasure dries up and there comes more hankering, yearning, craving. And it goes on and on and on in a cycle. And one never knows any kind of real inner peace, inner stillness, inner quietude of mind. And the bliss and pleasure one enjoys is of a low and inferior kind. If there was just a choice between the kind of dull apathy and sensual enjoyment, then the prudent person would take sensual enjoyment over dull apathy. But there are states of higher bliss, higher peace, culminating in the supreme bliss of liberation. And the pattern of indulging in sensuality is one of the big obstructions, the big barriers that prevents us from entering into that inner chamber of the bliss, of liberative bliss. And so now the Buddha, to drive home his point with another simile or example, he takes the case of the person who has the maximum access to objects of sensual enjoyment, a king or a royal minister. He says, have you ever seen or heard of a king or a king's minister enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, who without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and so on, was able to abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace? And then Magandhya has to admit that he has never heard or seen of a king or royal minister who could do so. And then he has to admit that, on the contrary, Magandhya admits that this is the case. He just says, no, Master Gotama. So then the Buddha is the one who says, I too have never seen or heard of a king or royal minister enjoying the five chords of sensual pleasure, who could abide with a mind inwardly at peace. On the contrary, Magandhya, it is those recluses or Brahmins who abide, who have abided in the past, or who abide or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, all do so after they have understood as they actually are the origin and disappearance, the gratification, danger, and escape in the case of sensual pleasures. And it is after abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and removing this fever for sensual pleasures that they abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. Okay, I think I will stop at this point. Of course, what remains can't be rushed through quickly. The remaining portion is actually, I would say, the deeper part of the sutra, the more difficult part. So it takes more explanation. But if there are any questions, comments pertaining to this part of the sutra, please. Questions? Okay, if there's no questions, then we'll just stop for the evening. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Maybe better after the class, yeah. Okay, then we will stop for the evening. Just to repeat what I said before the class started, we won't be having the class during this 10-day period when we have the meditation course. And then the first Tuesday after the course, I also cancel the class. That's July 1st. So the next sutta study class will be July 8th. In that class, I probably could finish the sutta a little early. Then I'm going to make some printouts of these. Just look very briefly at these suttas on the nature of samsara from the Samyutta Nikaya. If you have the Samyutta Nikaya translation, Connected Discourses, look at chapter 15 on the beginningless samsara. Okay, so now we transfer the share of the merit with the guardian deities and so on. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Avata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.